number three was very important in the Pythagorean thinking, because it relates also to an instinct which is experienced within the mystery of numeration itself. To the Pythagorean, the triad was the symbol of equilibrium in space. Inasmuch as the triad consists of three monads and two intervals. In other words, if you make three little dots in a row, you have three dots, and the spaces between them constitute two intervals, one on each side of the center dot, between it and the next dot. Thus, says Pythagoras also, we must never lose sight of the significance of interval. And we say that interval is important because it represents an intangible, non-existing thing which can at the same time exercise a moral force. In other words, interval is something that comes into being as the result of objects. And this interval becomes indispensable to the estimation of the objects themselves. Thus, interval equals instruction. And by interval, or by the concept of interval, conditioned existence is capable of estimating realities. And these realities are the little dots, the three dots, which in their own natures are inscrutable, but which may be estimated by interval and known most by the spaces between them rather than by their own natures. Why is this true? The reason this is true is because man, conceiving any order or group of things as monads, is utterly incapable of defining them. He may create a name for them, but this name does not mean that he apprehends their nature. Supposing we have three monads along in a row. We call one cat, the second dog, and the third mouse. Here are three monads, three beings. And the person does not live who can give an adequate definition of any one of them. We know a great deal, but we do not know what a cat is. Its essential nature is as inscrutable as the nature of the universe. And perhaps we were particularly wise in the selection of a cat, which is a monument to inscrutability in the majority of instances. People do not have cats for pets. Cats have people for pets. No one knows what a dog is. No one knows what a mouse is. No one knows what an oak tree is. No one knows why it is an oak tree, for it is only a name which we have given to it. And when we are asked what it is, we give this name and glibly assume that we have said something, when all we have done is had a mild outburst of language. The fact of any of these creatures is rooted in ground so deep and mysterious that the wisest man in the world has never penetrated it. Therefore, these three creatures sitting along in a row with a short interval between them remain inscrutable until they begin to move in the interval. We learn a certain something about what a cat is when it starts to chase the mouse. We know something of the nature of all these creatures by their reactions upon each other. And these reactions take place not in themselves, but in the spaces between themselves, qualitatively. Place anything in its environment, therefore, and permit it to function in a space equation, and then place at the boundaries of that equation other beings, things, or monads. And we will find that if one of these monads is a cup of milk, the cat will approach it. If one of these monads is a piece of cheese, the mouse will approach it. And we observe through these reactions of things upon each other what the attributes of these various creatures are. We place ourselves in an environmental relation to any group of monads. Observe the activities of these monads, their functions or their purposes, either their motions or their immutabilities. And conceiving of these things over periods of time in which such factors as growth, seasons, motions, generation, and reproduction occur, we thus gradually come to an environmental, circumstantial acquaintance with creatures which in themselves are unknowable, but are to be determined or discovered or to be analyzed only by their relationships with other things. These relationships, therefore, constitute the Pythagorean concept of intervals, because in these intervals, where reactions operate upon reactions and actions upon actions, we are able to perceive certain inherent qualities of bodies which cannot be discerned while these bodies are static and can only be known when they enter into a state of motion. And motion is movement within space interval. And this movement is a gradual signature by which each thing writes a kind of name for itself by what it does. In the same problem with human experience, man himself, through intervals, attempts association with other human beings, becoming thus gradually aware of their existences, not by what they are, but by what they do. Therefore, we cannot know the man who, closing the doors of his house, locks himself in and stays there indefinitely. The only thing we can then know about him relates to this action, which in turn may lead to certain conclusions. These conclusions might be wrong if we were able to know and approach this person. So whatever we do becomes the key to the presentation of ourselves to any other creature or any other being in the universe. By the similar token, the nature of deity in substance is unknowable. But when deity enters a state of motion and moves within the interval, which is enclosed by its own substance and nature, deity, by internal motion, causes the emergence from itself of what the Pythagoreans called the tetractys, the pyramid of dots, consisting of 10 monads arranged in 4 rows, which we will discuss in another lecture. But the internal motion of deity results in the generation of existence. This gives us another important definition. If an individual, upon a plane of abstraction, equivalent or nearly equivalent to his concept of that upon which deity abides, was to have an internal motion, what would we consider the nature of that motion to be? conceiving that as yet there is no world form such as we know it, no world mind such as we apperceive it. There is therefore only the initial or primal motion of being within itself. What could such a motion be? And the ancients could conceive of only one thing, and that is motion of consciousness within itself. This motion would therefore be an internal motion of consciousness. And the Greeks and the Orphics and the Pythagoreans generally assumed that creation was the result of an internal motion of the divine consciousness. If such is the case, how would we describe such a process on the level of our own functioning? We would therefore be required to assume that this creative motion of consciousness would correspond to our concept of meditation, realization, concentration, or one of those internal disciplines by which consciousness is caused to move within ourselves. This led the Greeks to assume that creation was therefore an internal experience in the divine consciousness, not an external one, because to the divine consciousness being totality, there can be no external. The only possible motion of eternity is within itself. The Brahmins of India have this same idea when in their explanation of the circumference of the body of God, they say that deity extends to the outer boundaries of absolute space and 3 inches beyond. In other words, there is a complete totality. As being is all there is, infinite in power and duration and infinite in extent, there can be no externalization of its nature. The only direction it can move is in, or move within. Plato and many of the other Greek philosophers assume that all motion of universal consciousness is from circumference to center, and therefore that deity in contemplation or eternal being in assuming the illusion of division within itself move toward its own center, and in so doing created the duality, the dot and the circle, and that this duality then represented a polarized experience of consciousness within total being. Now the Pythagoreans ask a very pertinent question. In this process of polarization, did being lose awareness of its own nature? In other words, was totality captured within its own basic diversity? Did the eternal concept of unity fail in space as it has failed in man, so that man is not capable of experiencing unity except by theoretical affirmation? That is, unless he has undertaken a very long and cathartic discipline under one of the great systems of mystical religion. Normally, he cannot accept or experience identity. Therefore, is the primary duality of being a condition which annihilates the unity of basic consciousness itself? Now then comes the greater question, which Pythagoras estimated with considerable skill, namely, whether totality possessed a consciousness in any way relative to ours, or whether what we call consciousness itself arose from the duad, or from duality, and whether the whole concept of consciousness is related to the idea of unit, one. And therefore, that consciousness did not exist until illusion set in. And that total being has a total awareness which is beyond the concept of consciousness. This we cannot follow, nor could Pythagoras, other than to suggest the possibility, the grave probability, that self-knowing is reserved to those creatures in which the polarity of division has already occurred. Because self-knowing is obviously in itself a fallacy. Self-knowing being the recognition of the fact of a separate selfness can only exist in conditioned beings. This led the Eastern Buddhists to refrain from any effort to define the state of the Mahaparinirvanic consciousness. In other words, the consciousness of the being which is identical with reality. Whether this is a conscious being, a universally aware being, or whether it is a totally submerged existence, no one has ever been able to dogmatically affirm. But we have the Pythagorean concept that duality, being the first of the numbers, must therefore imply that the state of consciousness rising from duality is the first of the illusions, and that from this illusion all others must naturally defend. In the study of the natural mathematics of the universe, the Pythagoreans began to experience the struggle which nature is perpetually maintaining to preserve equilibrium. In other words, that which is unbalanced must be restored, for nature is forever gravitating against excess. Now, why does nature gravitate against excess? Because excess is the tipping of the poles of polarity. And the moment that these poles are tipped, every force in the universe rushes toward the maintenance of equilibrium or the restoration of it. Unbalance, therefore, leads to motion. And wherever there is motion, there is some form of unbalance in nature. It is the problem of the sphere resting on the surface. If the surface is absolutely level, the sphere will stand still. But if the surface is not level, the sphere will begin to roll toward the lower part, or the depressed part of the surface. Thus, motion arises from imbalance or from the loss of even surfaces. And in the universe, that which is or becomes unbalanced immediately moves into the sphere or concept of dynamic. Thus, all dynamic must have a certain asymmetry. And we know in art that the dynamic symmetry of the great masters as Leonardo and Michelangelo, both of whom were profoundly acquainted with the Pythagorean doctrine, that the dynamic of these artists is always achieved by imbalance. We put a dot in the center, it is not interesting. If we put the face in a portrait in the center of the canvas, it is not interesting. We must place it off-center. We must create imbalance to call attention or to cause the sensory reaction of the observer to move. We move the individual by imbalance. Thus, we also move him by pain. We move him by war. We move him by crime. but we seldom ever move him by peace. We seldom have ever move him by virtue. Because things which are right and in their places are not dynamic. And it is much easier to get an individual to crusade against an evil than it is to get him to maintain a virtue. Because imbalance creates a dynamic reaction within man. The dynamic of the universe is therefore caused by imbalance. But the universe realizes that all unbalanced forces, as says the Zohar, must perish in the void. All unbalance ultimately leads to destruction, unless nature can restore equilibrium. So that what nature is attempting to do is to restore equilibrium. And equilibrium is in some way, therefore, directly related to unity. And imbalance is directly related to duality. Now, assuming that we achieve unity, we observe immediately that we move from an active to a passive state. Now, by active to passive, we mean from objective to subjective in many cases. Or we mean a departure from motion to that which is the suspension of motion. Now, which is the more dynamic, motion or the suspension of motion? Pythagoras answered, which is the most difficult to acquire? Anyone can move, but how many individuals can make a magnificent job of standing still? An individual becoming internally immovable find this state infinitely more difficult to sustain than any state of motion. They are, however, penalized by others for persons not realizing the possibility of a dynamic suspension of motion, associate motion with life and immovability with death, and conceive that that which does not move is dead. Pythagoras says, no, because that which is the root of all things cannot move. That is being itself. Because to move, a thing must pass from where it is to where it is not. And being is always everywhere. Therefore, there is no place for it to go. The dynamic principle, then, of the suspension of motion is never to be confused with the absence of motion. The suspension of motion is a positive state of restraint, or the poising of a thing perpetually upon its point. In other words, it relates to the sphere. The absence of motion is that which is represented by the exhaustion of vitality at the circumference of the area of its own field of energy. The exhaustion of vitality comes as the result of motion rather than the result of the suspension of motion. Motion, therefore, leads to negative exhaustion. Suspension of motion is neither positive nor negative, but partakes of the nature of being itself. Now the Pythagoreans believed, therefore, that in the numeration or the numeral three, the triad, that there was imposed or interposed between the polarities of the duad a third point, which was the point of equilibrium. The Pythagoreans then declared that contrary to our practical or popular practice of placing good and bad on the pans at the two ends of a pair of scales, weighing the good against the evil, and observing that to be good in which the side of the scale containing good was the heaviest. The Pythagorean said that these two, the weighing of good and evil, were the weighing of two illusional polarities, one against the other. And that the only point of reality in such a matter was the middle of the beam. Therefore, they said, of polarities, ill or evil is at both ends, and good at the center only. Therefore, the point of good is not opposed to evil, but is in equilibrium between two forms of excess, both evil. Now, a practical experience of that can be considered in the problem of the individual with his money. Money is not evil, but the use of it may cause it to become a great cause of danger. The individual who hoards his money is called a miser. This is one extreme. The individual who wastes his money is called a spendthrift. This is the other extreme. These are the two ends of the balance, both unbalanced. But the individual who moderately uses his means for that which is of the greater good is at the center, the point of equilibrium. Therefore, in possession, use is the point of equilibrium, and abuse, either by excess or by privation, these are the two polarities, and they are both wrong. This is the reason for the concept of the golden mean, represented in symbolism by the golden cut of Aristotle, and also by the famous Socratic axiom, in all things, not too much. Thus, equilibrium comes as a balance between the aggression of polarities. In the creative triad of things, we have also the problem in the human soul of what is going to impose itself between the aggressive triad which is created in man's nature. This aggressive triad can be conceived of as existing in all parts of his constitution. And we may say that for one of these triad polarities, we can say the mind and the emotions. These two are polarized. And if either one of them is weighed against the other, or enters into competition with the other, or goes into conflict with the other, or seeks to overpower the other, or take upon itself the prerogatives of the other, there is confusion, discord, imbalance, and destruction. So the Pythagoreans believed that there was a principle which was representing, or which did represent, the primordial monad that descended and took its place on the level of number and placed itself between the poles of the two and created equilibrium. And the name which they gave to this central monad was the beautiful. Now, the beautiful was to them the symbol of the healing of polarity. It became art as a great moderator of the excesses of life. Thus, we have the art of living. We have the fine arts. But we have beauty, which is always seeking order and is seeking to impose its own archetype upon all excess and bring it back into moderation. Beauty, therefore, becomes to the Greeks the symbol of the universal Redeemer, because beauty is an experience of equilibrium, even in the absence of the equilibrium itself. The artist lives in a world world in which he conceives and creates or releases beauty which he intuitively feels. And in the process of doing this, he is like the true artist who becomes the handmaiden of nature. And in the terms of the medieval alchemist, there is the great statement, art perfects nature. If an artist, therefore, goes out on the side of a hill to paint, and he sees several trees blowing against the sky, his eye will tell him that there are too many trees for his purpose. So when he paints the picture, he will leave out unnecessary trees, although they are there, and reduce his picture to the law and order which he regards as proper. In the same way, the artist in man gradually proceeds to put in order all the visible, tangible, or recognizable excesses or imbalances of nature around him. In his own creativity, in his own internal life, therefore, the artist censors nature and attempts to assert a vision of unity, a vision of order, upon the phenomenal indications of disorder that may appear around him. The artist does this by releasing a creativity within himself and flowing out across the two intervals which divide the end points or dots from the center one in the little row of three dots. The beautiful then becomes the symbol of equilibrium, polarity, balanced, the restoration of order, and by that, the restoration also of the divine order and of the golden age, as the Greeks called it. This principle of the beautiful likewise gives rise out of mathematical formula to the messianic concept. For the second person of the creative triad, the Redeemer, the link between the divine and the mortal, the Son of Man and the Son of God, this heroic creature, this Savior, which stands between, in the middle distance, and is crucified between the two thieves of polarized excess, represents in each instance the ordinating, integrating power of beauty. Not beauty merely of external things, but the pure beauty which is part of the inner concept or consciousness of equilibrium. For equilibrium represents beauty, and beauty is actually the suspension of excess in all things, and the restoration of immovable principles which have been obscured by the motion of generated forms. This is also according to the concept of the Orphic. The Pythagoreans then completed their great picture of the basic pattern of number and numeration by the establishment of the tetrad, or the great pattern of the numeration four. And the numeration four was to them the primary symbol of justice, because four is the first number to be composed of even and natural parts. It is the first number equally divisible, because they did not regard the two as a number of this kind, since division of it could result only in the primordial one, which is not possible in the universe. Therefore, four, the product of the addition of two even numbers, was to them the symbol of order, of justice, and of the regaining or reestablishing of balance in nature. Also, the tetrahedron or the four-face symmetrical solid is the least geometric form which can enclose an area. Therefore, this number four was also the proper symbol of the mundane world, which is the peculiar revealer of law. For just as surely as things enter into generation and become involved in the mystery of matter, so surely they come under the direct and inevitable jurisdiction of universal law. And the physical universe as we see it is the amphitheater of law, in which all things, by the process of existence, become inevitably and instinctively aware of law, and learn either to abide by it or suffer its consequences. Therefore, the material sphere is a lawful state of souls, in which all things come to learn obedience, and come to learn to accept the inevitability and immutability of the sovereign principles from which they are suspended. Thus, this world, this material world, is the symbol of the administrative power of deity. And deity itself, extending from the mysterious and hypothetical one, which is the intellect of the world, through the mystery of diversity, which is the intellectual extension of the intellect into the sphere of mind, from there to the equilibrium, or the generation of the power of soul, for soul is the geometric pattern of the beautiful, and finally into form, into the four-square world of matter, composed of the four elements known to the ancients, the great hollow square, which is the amphitheater of existence, the ball court of the ancient Aztec Indians, where they played the game of life upon the square of the world. These four numbers, then, by their addition, the four to the three to the two to the one, equal the number 10, which in itself is the exhaustion of all numbers and the restoration of the monad. We will later see how these numbers are extended through the pentad and on to the decade, or the end of the numerical system. But for our present purposes, we are concerned primarily with the recognition of this descent of principles called numerations, which are each one of them formulas for the application of the concept of the numeral to the phenomenal sphere of existence, so that out of the entire concept comes an inevitable philosophy of life, a philosophy of life in one of the purest symbolical forms that we know, because it is in a form so simple, so direct, and so inevitable that it is almost impossible to confuse it with theological abstractions. It becomes an obvious, clear-cut concept of the descent of principles in their own spheres and in their own orders and in their own ways, moving victoriously from unity in reality to diversity in appearance or illusion. Now, assuming that we gathered up totally all of the various parts of the universe that have come into being and manifestation since the dawn or the beginning or the first spark was seen in space, and we total all of these, what would their relation be to the primary consciousness which engendered them? We say that populations are increasing, that there are more folks on Earth than there used to be, and that there may be a time in which the Earth will be so crowded that it will almost be essential that nature itself step in and limit propagation, as it has done on numerous occasions. in lesser theaters which we have analyzed? The answer to this question lies in the indisputable fact that the growth and unfoldment of things and their numerical increase, either in magnitude or in multitude, can have no effect upon totality, inasmuch as nothing can outgrow totality. And no two things, regardless of how vast they may be, can individually ever exceed one half of totality. Or four things can ever exceed in each one-fourth of totality. It is therefore not possible for one part of totality to grow so great that it will crowd out another part. Nor is it possible for the situation to finally become so incredible that it is necessary to revise the boundaries of totality itself. Such things cannot be. Why? Because of archetype. Archetype being the image or design in the divine mind. Nor can God nor man think beyond itself. The divine mind can contain no concept superior to its own totality. Therefore, it can engender nothing that can exceed itself. And as all things by their growth are, as the Bible says, filling up their numbers. And you will find the same quotation used in one of the Shakespeare plays. It is therefore inevitable that all things can fill only the patterns by which their own life ways are promised or perfected. What then occurs when things seem to exceed themselves? And therefore it would appear that the next step that they make would inevitably break through the pattern and result in what Pythagoras termed a superabundant number. The moment things increase beyond a certain point, they do not outgrow themselves. They grow into the archetypal unity which is next superior to them. Thus, two things growing to become greater than they are unite to form one thing which already exists archetypally as the next inevitable step of themselves. Things outgrowing themselves, therefore, do not outgrow their creator, but outgrow a level of creation, and are immediately integrated in a larger unity. That is, life is not a continuous expression or unfoldment of separate parts. There can never be a superabundance of number. If a tree, for example, could keep on growing, on and on and on, like Jack's proverbial beanstalk, it is conceivable that one tree might sometime fill all space, like the Yggdrasil tree of the ancient Nordic religious rites. But this does not happen, because growth, in itself, is a motion toward unity, and not toward the infinite extension of an individual number throughout eternity. Things, therefore, grow together. And all growth is a union of parts and the reestablishment of unities. When things outgrow themselves, they have merely fulfilled their part of something else. And superabundance is merely, therefore, the projection of a thing towards the next state of itself, which is already archetypally established. And as things, by their advancement, become more and more refined and less in number, evolution ends gradually in the resolving of numbers. In other words, if a creature beginning at a state of multiplicity at the base of the pyramid of evolution grows, supposing we will say that he grows from 100 roots which he has planted in faculties, powers, dimensions, propensities, and other phases of his own being. As he ascends, these 100 parts do not continue to grow as 100 trees of life within him. The first step upward that he takes, the 100 become 90. The next step, the 90 becomes 80. And instead of growing to superabundance, he grows to unity and reestablishes the identical numerational identity with which he started. Thus, growth is the gradual reduction of number, because by means of it, numbers die in numeration again. And each step of number means a return of some part of the number concept into its numerical overtone or archetype. So the creature who began with many ends with one. The race that begins as an infinite number of individuals ends as one being. Growth, therefore, cannot result in an infinite multiplication of races until space is full of them, because growth gradually ascends like a pyramid to an apex. And all growing things decrease in multitude of parts and magnitude of size until the concept of totality is reestablished as a fact of being and not as a continued individual existence. The end of things, therefore, is their re-identification with total being. And the end of growth is not that God will produce competitor gods who are going to try to wrest heaven from him as Saturn sought to take the throne of Uranus. Rather, the return toward consciousness is the re-identification of principles over division, or the restoration of the unity of divided parts. So as growth may produce the appearance of diversity, growth also symbolizes maturing or unfolding of consciousness. And all growth is to the expansion of form, and all consciousness is toward the identity of life. And as the battle between form and consciousness is always ultimately won by consciousness, identity always is victorious, and the divided parts return to form the basic unity from which they were originally engendered. Thus, in the Pythagorean concept, what we call evolution is total being, which has been infinitely fragmented within itself, but remains archetypally an absolute unity, gradually restores on the plane of phenomena the fact of this unity. But as it proceeds in this direction, it runs against the inevitable fact that the primordial unity was not upon this plane. And therefore, as the processes of unification advance, the beings themselves retire to these other planes sequentially, until unity is ultimately factually achieved on the plane where the beginning was made, because it is only on that plane that absolute unity can be experienced. This is all set forth and revealed through the pattern of numbers, and opens to us a very large vista. I think, however, that perhaps the most important lesson to be gained from the basic concept is that the individual should realize that manyness in whatever form it exists, is an appearance. To accept it is to be deceived by it, and through this deceit, to permit the continuance of the consciousness of separateness within the soul. For whatever we perceive externally and accept through the perceptive power, we receive as a doctrine in the psychic nature. Therefore, by the constant reaffirmation of separateness, we indoctrinate ourselves with our own deceit. Whereas, if we are as wise as the Pythagoreans were, we shall attempt, even with limited faculties and powers, to discover and identify unities, and to think of all groupings and accumulations of powers, forces, circumstances, nations, races, individuals, as parts of new unities forming to continue the process of revealing primordial identity. If we can therefore conceive of all parts as indispensable to the totality, if we can understand in the Pythagorean manner why the powers of the universe are mindful of each sparrow's fall, they would then realize that the universe cannot be complete without that sparrow. For totality can never be established while there is a deficiency in any part of it. This, incidentally, also implies that in totality, there can never be less than there was in the beginning. Therefore, that no form of essential life can cease. No order of life can fail. No body of living things can be utterly annihilated. For at the end, the number of the parts must be equal to the number of parts that primordially existed in the archetypal diffusion. And while this number is infinite, the great power of unity lies in its totality. And in the concept of totality, there can be no space for imperfection, limitation, or the frustration of parts. All things, whether they know it or not, whether they understand or not, whether they believe or not, are inevitably moving into these vast totality patterns. There are no lost souls, no hopeless state, no damned spirits. There can only be ultimately a totality reestablished by the return of all the parts to their original cause, and at that time there cannot one be missing. Thus growth is a continual and eternal restatement of monads or of numerations over numbers. And every time we reach a hand out and take the hand of a friend, we have made a symbol of a unity. We have brought together two divided parts. And as long as we remain true to this, we shall have increased or restated the principle of unity in all things. Therefore, by unity, we forever reveal truth. By diversity, we forever reveal error. And any act that is performed toward the establishment of unity is sacred. And any act which is performed for the purpose of division is profane. For it is the will of the infinite that all things shall be one, and being one shall restore the infinite to the fullness and completeness of itself. And when all divided parts within unity are reestablished, unity is restored to equilibrium. Time and eternity cease. And that which is the absolute suspension of being, total and complete eternity and inevitability, is reestablished, and the infinite remains itself in the total recognition of its own reality. This, in substance, is the Pythagorean theory of creation and the principle behind the concept of numeration and number. And we will proceed with this to the next step of our study a week from this evening.
Neither that I was in earth mind. I believe now.